State Technology and Regulatory Council. Welcome to today's training, Bioavailability of Contaminants in Soil, Considerations for Human Health Risk Assessment. My name is Nicole Henderson. I'll be your moderator today, and I'm located in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Briefly, just a reminder that the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of the States. It is a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams that produce tools, resources, and training courses like the one we are in today. We'd love to have you as part of ITRC. If you are not currently a member, please visit ITRC at itrcweb.org to find out more about how you can participate in any of our active technical teams or look for additional opportunities on training. Here on slide five, I'm welcoming our trainers today. They were all members of the team helping to put the guidance document together and have served more times than they realized they would as trainers for this class. So we really appreciate them sticking with us and are looking forward to a great class today. So with that, if we are gonna turn over, I'm gonna welcome Jeff to come off of mute while I provide him with the remote control access. Welcome, Jeff.
Thanks, Nicole. So here's what we're gonna be covering today. First, we'll discuss why to use bioavailability. Second, an overview of its scientific concepts. We'll be doing two case studies, one on arsenic, followed by one on lead, then a more in-depth discussion of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, wrapping up with a taking action session. There'll be two Q&A sessions, like Nicole mentioned, but you can always put your questions in the Q&A box as we move through. And Nicole, I seem to be stuck, so can you advance for me? Thanks. So let's just jump right in with the concept of bioavailability. The idea here is that not all of a contaminant ingested with soil moves into the bloodstream. For reference, we eat about 100 milligrams a day of soil. Kids eat about 200 milligrams of soil. So to the right, you can see a conceptual overview of the process. So contaminated soil is ingested. It goes into the GI tract, the stomach and the intestines. Within the GI tract, some portion of the contaminant will be extracted from the soil, like you're doing a digestion in the lab. That portion that's in solution in the GI system is the bioaccessible fraction of the contaminant, meaning it's in the body, but it's not yet in the bloodstream and then therefore potentially impacting other organs throughout the body. As the contaminants move through the GI system, some portion may move across the cell walls and into the bloodstream and other organs. That is the bioavailable fraction. And if it doesn't move into the bloodstream or into the body, it's then excreted from the body and doesn't impact it. Nicole, can you put up the poll question for me? So the question is, if contaminants pass through, meaning they're not absorbed from the human gastrointestinal tract, do they contribute to systemic risk? This is just trying to drive this home. We want people to really think about this. So if everybody could answer this for me. We'll give another minute. So Nicole, I say I'm just seeing the poll slide, but I'm not seeing the results. Oh, there we go. All right. Thanks, everybody. So the correct answer is no. The risk assessment process for ingestion of contaminated soil focuses on risk from systemic exposure to contaminants in soil. We'll be going through all of this as we move through the training. And I'm still frozen. Can you exam? There we go. So in this training, you should learn how to value the ITRC document as a resource, to determine when a site-specific assessment should be used, to understand arsenic, lead, and PAH specific factors, how to conduct a bioavailability study, and how to use the data in risk assessment. I'm going to advance. Why look at bioavailability in soils? Foremost, It more accurately measures exposures and risk, thereby reducing uncertainty in the risk assessment process. It can lead to more effective use of resources without compromising health protection. This is a key concept to remember. Health is in no way being compromised by using this method. It may reduce remediation costs and increase flexibility, hopefully being able to allow you to focus your funding on spots that really need the remediation. And just wrap up, the site-specific risk assessment allows for modifying exposure factors to better represent site conditions. Next slide. The ITRC guidance document. So there's a splash page of it. It was developed over several years by a team of regulators, academic scientists, and consultants. And we recommend going to the website after the presentation to familiarize yourself with it. Actually, even though I was both an author and am a trainer, I actually use it all the time just to refresh my memory on the vast amount of information that's in there. It's not set up as a large tome that you have to dig through. The individual sections are easily accessible, so you can get in and get the information you need and get back to what you're working on. Next slide. The focus of this training and guidance is bioavailability of contaminants in soil to humans, specifically focused on human health. If you're needing guidance on bioavailability in sediment or ecological receptors, ITRC has a different training that you can access. We will focus on arsenic, lead, and polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. These are contaminants of high interest for which we have a lot of data applicable to a wide range of scenarios. The guidance can be used for assessing bioavailability of other contaminants. The protocols are going to be the same, but it's going to require more work on your part to find the correct methods and comparative studies that will need to be used. We'll show you how to do that later on. We focus on the soil ingestion pathway, not contaminated foodstuff consumption or inhalation. We will talk about dermal bioavailability as it relates to PAHs. Lead and arsenic are assumed to have no dermal bioavailability, but the organic PAH molecules do. Next slide. The bioavailability tools available from this training are, well, first and foremost, the guidance document that we put together. Again, there's loads of information in there. In particular, the decision process flowchart, which you'll find in section 4.1. We'll actually use this as we walk through both of the case studies that we'll be presenting. There's a pretty extensive definition of terms, and this is actually important because this topic crosses several fields, and some of the terms used have very specific meaning. There's also a review checklist in there, which is actually really helpful and gives you an idea of what you should be looking for in a complete bioavailability study, whether you're planning one or analyzing one that's being proposed. Next slide. So this is a regulator's testimonial. One group member, it's a geologist with Oregon DEQ, who first used bioavailability while working to remediate a 17-mile roadbed built with arsenic-containing mine tailings. The initial assessment called for removal of all the contaminated material. The responsible party brought in a consultant who suggested assessing arsenic bioavailability, and the regulatory team was on board. This assessment showed much lower risk, so the bioavailability of the arsenic was much lower than what was assumed, and this led to lower costs while still protecting human health. Nicole, can you put the Cole question up for us? We're just wanting to know, how familiar are you with bioavailability processes for contaminants in soil? And okay. Oh, good. So we've got a few with expert, about half with little or no experience, and some with about half with some knowledge and experience. That's great. When we started off, there was definitely many more people who had no experience with this process. So we're glad to see that the word is getting out there. And now I'll be turning it over to Yvette Launey to discuss bioavailability basics.
Thanks, Jeff. Let's see if I can advance the slides here. Okay. It's not working for me either, Nicole, so I'll just ask you to. Okay. Hello, everybody. So I am just going to go through a little bit of the background of bioavailability assessment, sort of the history, how we came to recognize this as an issue that should be incorporated into human health risk assessment. Some key definitions, as Jeff said, there are some terminology that is used in very precise ways. And to point out some concepts that are applicable to all chemicals. As Jeff said, and we'll say over and again in here, we're focusing on a couple of specific chemicals, but all of these concepts that we're discussing are applicable to all chemicals. I also want to talk about in vivo studies and in vitro studies and what an IVIVC, in vivo to in vitro correlation is, because that may come up in regulatory efforts. And then I'll finish up with some discussion of soil properties that affect bioavailability. Next slide. So this is a slide that is pulled from a paper that was published by Martha Steele in 1990. And basically it is, she collected data on children's blood lead levels at lead contaminated sites. So across the bottom here, we have several different sites. Each of these bars indicates a different site. They've been collected into smelter sites, sites where the lead source was urban, like from gasoline, and then some mining sites where the mining activities had contributed to soil lead levels. And then on the y-axis is this kind of funny unit of change in blood lead per change of 1,000 part per million soil lead. Conceptually, what this is that she was looking at what happens to children's blood lead as soil lead goes up. And so you can see that at some of these sites, so at all of the sites, they identified a relationship between soil lead concentrations and blood lead concentrations. But at some of the sites, you know, particularly these smelter sites and urban sites that are on the left-hand side of each of the graphs, there was a very tight relationship that children's blood lead levels went up quite a bit as soil lead levels went up. But conversely, there were some other sites, especially some mining sites, where there was a very poor relationship between blood lead level and soil lead levels. The soil lead levels had to go up quite a bit in order to detect any change in children's blood lead levels. So you can imagine that if you were in Telluride and had a population where the children really were not showing elevated blood lead levels, and a regulatory agency was coming in saying, well, we need to clean up all the soil at your site because we have to prevent these kind of blood lead levels associated with these studies from urban and smelter sites, you might not be that happy about it, and you might want to invest in some research to understand this better. So next slide. So those were studies, that last slide presented epidemiology data, right? Studies on humans. Now that's the one great thing about COVID, people know what epidemiology is. So the same relationship was then subsequently established in animal studies. So this figure provides data from EPA published in 2007. So the dark blue line, the x-axis here is the day of a study. So they did a 2-week study where they administered lead to swine every day. And on the y-axis are the blood lead levels in these animals. So you can see control animals who get no lead in their diet, they basically don't see any elevations in blood lead levels. But if you administer a high soluble dose of lead, you see a very precipitous and clear dose trend in increasing blood lead levels. So that's what this top green line is. Next slide. If you administer soluble lead, but at a lower dose, we see a dose response relationship. So you still see elevated blood lead levels, but you see a lower level of response in the blood lead from the lower dose. Next slide. But what was interesting to find was that if you give the same dose of lead in a soluble form or in soil, you may get very different results. So this is a matched dose between soluble lead and lead in soil at a site. And the response in blood lead levels is much lower. Next slide. And similarly, if you match the dose, but to the lower dose level, you see the same dose response trend, but with the results lower from soil. Next slide. So actually go back one slide. I just want to point out, so this was a particular slide and an RBA value can be calculated from these data here. EPA studied many sites and evaluated several soils and saw that the relationship, the relative bioavailability from soil compared to the soluble dose ranged considerably across sites. So there are values from mostly Western contaminated sites where relative bioavailability values range from 10% to more than 90% of the soluble dose. So apparently there are really site-specific factors coming into play. Next slide. So although that research was done in 2007, when EPA put together risk assessment guidance for Superfund, which is, I believe, still considered the Bible for conducting risk assessment and risk assessment guidance. When that was written decades earlier, the authors understood that this might be an issue. And so the language from RAGS, risk assessment guidance document, is if the medium of exposure at a site, like soil, differs from the medium of exposure assumed in a toxicity value, such as a soluble dose, an absorption adjustment may be appropriate. And then it goes on to say to adjust a food or soil ingestion exposure to estimate to match an RFD or a cancer slope factor based on drinking water, you may have to incorporate this kind of adjustment. Next slide. So the regulatory community understood this, even though it was overlooked in the initial phases or initial stages of things like this Superfund cleanups. But any of you have done risk assessments, you know there are different components to it. So there is a toxicity assessment and an exposure assessment. And both of those have relevance in the risk assessment, and both of those are affected by considerations of bioavailability. Next slide. So you may need to think about a site-specific relative bioavailability adjustment if you have soil ingestion exposures, for example, where the critical toxicity study uses a different medium of exposure. So we want to account for that difference. So the way I think about this is that the toxicity assessment, which is where the RFD or cancer slope comes from, it has bioavailability assumptions implicit in it. So for example, with arsenic, where the cancer slope factor is based on exposure to soluble arsenic in drinking water, that it turns out that arsenic from drinking water is highly bioavailable. So then when you go down to an exposure assessment where you have a contaminated site, where you have a contaminated site with contaminated soil, you may need to incorporate this relative bioavailability adjustment to accommodate the difference between these two exposure medium in the assessment. All right, I am able to advance now, Nicole. The relative oral bioavailability adjustment, or RBA, is a comparison of the bioavailability of chemical in different dosing media. So in our conversation today, it's going to be a comparison of the absolute bioavailability of the contaminant from soil relative to the absolute bioavailability from the form of that contaminant dosed in the critical toxicity study. So so that form the RFD or cancer slope factor. This is a conventional type of exposure calculation that would be done to calculate exposure. It takes into consideration such things as concentration of the contaminant in soil, how often the soil is ingested, how much is ingested, how long it's ingested, and averaging time and body weight. These are all factors that go into calculating dose from a contaminated site. But the consideration for relative bioavailability can be built directly into those calculations. And we'll talk about this more later in the presentation. So the concepts we're talking about relate to all chemicals. We focus in this document and in this training and much of the research that has been done to date on lead, arsenic, and PAHs. And that is because they are chemicals for which there is a lot of toxicity information, and they really drive risk assessments at contaminated sites. So the other thing I want to talk about is, and Jeff touched on this too, is something that we call the bioaccessible fraction or bioaccessibility. And that is the mass of a chemical that is soluble from soil, for example, in a laboratory experiment, divided by the total mass of the chemical present in the soil. So it is the fraction of the total amount of the chemical present that is soluble and therefore possibly available for uptake. There are lots of in vitro methods that attempt to characterize this parameter. And you'll see that we use the terms bioaccessibility, bioaccessible fraction, in vitro bioaccessibility, IVBA, all of these are terms for the same thing. This is a schematic that illustrates the concepts of bioavailability and bioaccessibility. So Jeff talked about the image on the left. On the top here, we have a schematic of bioaccessibility. So you have a contaminant in soil, you do some in vitro testing in a laboratory, and you can assess how much of the contaminant is soluble from the soil. And we refer to that as the bioaccessible fraction or the in vitro bioaccessibility. Whereas bioavailability requires studies in animals. So you have this contaminant soil, you dose it to animals, you then measure an endpoint. It might be blood, it could be urine. There are other measurement endpoints, but this you have to refer to something as a bioavailable fraction. It implies study in animals. So from a regulatory perspective, so the bioaccessible fraction can be informative and useful in estimating whether or not you might have bioavailability considerations for your risk assessment. From a regulatory perspective, to date in the United States, what has needed to be done is that an IVIVC needs to be developed. And so that is where several substrates are studied in vitro, and the exact same substrates are also measured for bioavailability in vivo. And then the line of regression for the relationship between those two endpoints gives you an equation. So once you have an IVIVC, which exists for chemicals such as lead and arsenic, then you don't have to do an expensive and time-consuming bioavailability study in animals. You can do a bioaccessibility study with established bioaccessibility methods. So you can measure bioaccessibility, which can be done quickly and inexpensively. Use this regression relationship then to predict relative bioavailability, and that can be used in the risk assessment. So if that regression, the IVIVC, demonstrates a good relationship, then it means that you have a pretty good correlation. And so your IV-IVC can give you a good prediction of bioavailability from the bioaccessibility data. It may be that you do this study and you cannot establish that the bioaccessibility or the in vitro methods are really doing a very good job of predicting the bioavailability, in which case it is not going to be considered a valid surrogate for estimating bioavailability. So quite a bit of work has been done looking at bioavailability, especially for lead and arsenic, which is what is captured in this study. And so we know some of the factors that affect bioavailability. So on the left side of this figure are things that are low bioavailability, and on the right-hand side are things that are associated with high bioavailability. So one of the things that can have a huge effect is the mineral phase of metals in soil. So for example, if you have a contaminated site where it's a mine site and the lead is present as lead sulfide or the arsenic is present as arsenopyrite, you have a high likelihood of doing some bioaccessibility testing to establish that you have low bioavailability of the metals in these soils. And conversely, if you have a site where you have arsenates or lead carbonates, it's likely that you are going to find that the bioavailability of the metals, lead and arsenic from those soils are going to be high. Another factor that has been shown to have a big effect is the particle size. So I always talk about trying to stir my sugar into iced tea. You know, intuitively, we know that larger particles dissolve more slowly. You know, if you throw chunks of salt into, you know, coarse salt into your pasta water, the coarse salt will dissolve more slowly than a finely divided salt will. Similarly, if you use the raw sugar from, you know, to sweeten your iced tea, it takes longer to get it to dissolve than if you use finely divided white sugar. So particle size, because of this extra surface area on small particles, can really affect solubility. And because the soil is moving through the gastrointestinal tract and may only be solubilized in the high acid environment of the stomach, this particle size can affect bioavailability. There are also factors associated that are with the soil that are soil specific. So for example, for arsenic, reactive clay oxides might have a very big impact on bioavailability. And similarly, the source of the contamination might be important. For example, in mining ores, the metals may be encased in quartz. And even if you have lots of lead inside of this quartz matrix, if the quartz isn't dissolving in the gastrointestinal tract, the lead can't be liberated. Similarly, slag may encapsulate or provide a rinding around the metal and keep it from being liberated, as opposed to just free minerals that are more accessible to dissolution in the gastrointestinal tract. So there is a poll question. Nicole, can you bring that up? And while you guys are filling that out, I'm going to just talk a little bit about the existing guidance. So right now, there is starting to emerge guidance on how to incorporate bioavailability considerations into risk assessments. There are federal and state guidance on lead and arsenic. The EPA allows for a default bioavailability for lead and arsenic in risk assessment of 60% from soil. Lead and arsenic in soil, you can build into your risk assessment a 60% relative bioavailability adjustment. EPA has also looked at dioxins and completed a review of the available information, and their conclusion was Well, it looks like there are site-specific factors that affect the bioavailability of dioxins, but we don't yet understand what all of those are. And in fact, the regulatory agencies won't even make a claim for a preferred animal model for doing that research. There's also state guidance emerging. California and Hawaii both have guidance on arsenic and have IVIVC values that can be used, relationships that can be used. And there are starting to emerge a lot of site-specific precedents for lead, arsenic, and then other chemicals, cadmium, dioxins, and PAHs. So our poll was, does the state you work in use bioavailability when using conducting risk assessments? And 41% of you said yes, about 14% said no, and about half said we don't know. So we are really encouraged that more and more states are going over to incorporating human health, bioavailability adjustments and human health risk assessments. And our hope is that these trainings help advance that. So with that, that is the background information I'm going to present, and I'm going to hand it over to Kevin Long and Valerie Hamley. Valerie, for doing a case study.
Thanks so much, Yvette. I really appreciate that background and introduction. So as Yvette said, Kevin Long and I are going to work ourselves through a case study for an arsenic site. I do want to preface this that we are, looking at a very simplified hypothetical site where we are only looking at arsenic and we are only considering human health risk. So those are just important things to consider, and this is for simplicity as we move through the training. And hopefully I can switch these slides. Oh, we went a couple, there we go. Okay, so we're gonna work through this case study by using this flow chart that is provided in the guidance document. We've got two slides here to show you kind of the different phases that we work through. And so we're gonna go through each one of these steps with a case study to help you determine whether or not a site-specific bioavailability study would make sense for your site that has arsenic contamination. And this was provided as part of your related links when you signed up, when you registered for today's meeting. So we're just gonna work our way through each one of these questions as we go. Sorry, it's been slow in responding to me moving through here, but we're gonna work our way all the way from the initial questions of, does this involve soil ingestion? Because that's really important, all the way to cost benefit analysis and then some other further considerations that we need to think about. So here is our case study, and I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Kevin Long to walk us through this.
Thanks, Valerie. So as she mentioned, this is a hypothetical, but hopefully what this will do is give you a little bit of a sense of how to potentially approach projects where you have sites that might need to or wish to consider incorporating the concept of relative bioavailability of contaminants in soil into the analysis. So actually, just to set this up, this is a site. It is a former agricultural parcel. It has a history to it where there is some expectation that there were pesticides that might have been used that could have contained arsenic. And for the most part, in order to make the case simple in this situation, we're going to presume that the site has basically consistent soil type across its entire, all of the land that you can see here. So Val, you can go to the next site. So this site has some understanding of the history. You know, we have the ability to kind of get a sense of how the property was used in the past. And actually, the way it turns out, there were eight individual fields that were separately farmed. And then there's actually a ninth area that was used both as a residence and as a support facility for the agricultural use. So there was, you know, potentially pesticide usage in that area. So Val, what might be the first thing we should consider as part of, you know, navigating through this process if we're interested in potentially accounting for bioavailability in our project?
Yeah, Kevin, as you can see here, our first question as part of this flowchart is, does the project focus on human exposure to contaminated soil? And that's because all of the information that is provided in our guidance document is specifically regarding human exposure and its soil ingestion pathway. So that's why that's the very first question we ask, is if human exposure is the main pathway we're looking at.
So that is actually what we're dealing with here. The site is planned for redevelopment. So we are concerned about human exposures at this site, in particular, exposures that might occur under a residential and or recreational use. What's intended is a mixed use here where portions of the site will be used as recreational space, you know, trails, green space, maybe even playgrounds, and other portions of the site will be used for homes. So I guess, you know, based upon that, you know, if you go to the next slide, we have obviously the presence of, you know, individuals, whether they're, you know, at their homes, you go to the next slide, maybe they're recreating or playing at their homes. And so, yes, absolutely, 100%. We are looking at a situation here in which we could have residential and or recreational use, and therefore, you know, human exposure is something that we're very concerned about. So what might be the next thing we should consider?
Yeah, so again, these methods really look at the soil ingestion pathway, not inhalation and not dermal. So you would wanna know that the risk driver is actually that soil ingestion pathway, to make sure that these methods would actually have an impact on your site evaluation. And that's because this is our calculation. I think Yvette showed this earlier, but the relative bioavailability, you know, this is the number that we developed through these analyses. It is only on the ingestion of soil that you apply these. So you don't apply it to the concentration that's suspected for inhalation or for dermal. And then next slide, please. The other really important consideration is what your background concentration of arsenic is on your site. And this is really important because arsenic is typically present just naturally in soils at concentrations above risk-based screening levels. So this is a really general map of the United States, but it shows the concentrations of arsenic that we can see in background. And then you'll see down here at the bottom, we have what the both US EPA regional screening level and then the California DTSC screening level is for soil, both of which are under 1 milligram per kilogram. And these numbers do, I wanna say, also take into consideration that default bioavailability of 60% that Yvette mentioned earlier. And so you do definitely want to take your background concentration into consideration as you move forward through your site evaluation.
Okay, so actually in order to help us get what we might need to be able to characterize the potential risks to those residential and or recreational receptors via incidental ingestion, we've gone ahead and characterized concentrations of arsenic in soil across this property. What you can see from these dots, this is a conceptualization of the sampling that was performed, you know, every point representing a soil sample. You can see we actually targeted each of those individual fields just to see if there were differences in concentrations across those different uses. As I mentioned before, the soil type is relatively homogeneous across the property, so that removes one element of uncertainty in terms of changes that might impact bioavailability. On the left-hand side of this slide, you'll see there are a couple of additional points. What we did was we also sampled the area that we were pretty confident had no potential impact or at least use of pesticides, such that we could get some sense of what naturally occurring concentrations of arsenic were in soil. And as you can see, that the concentrations that we're seeing in the farm fields and in the residential area and the support area were significantly higher than we're seeing that in those naturally occurring areas. The numbers that you see here are actually the mean concentrations that were observed in each of these fields. So you can see we have a pretty decent range of concentrations generally, but for the most part, you can see that we end up with concentrations that are above that naturally occurring level. And since we're concerned about risk, so that we can make decisions about the possibility of managing or addressing that exposure prior to redevelopment, we went ahead and did an initial risk assessment, Valerie, and we ended up using that generic or that default relative bioavailability adjustment of 60% for arsenic. And this is what we get for each of those fields. These are essentially risk estimates, both cancer and non-cancer risk estimates that we've calculated for each field. And then based upon those results and the risk management regime in this area, about 65% of our site is going to have to be managed before we can redevelop, before we can occupy. So that's a pretty significant footprint for the redevelopment. It's a lot of material, a lot of soil that would have to be managed, have to be moved. So in many ways, the environmental footprint of this redevelopment of this work is pretty substantial. So I guess with that in mind, is there anything that we could do to possibly improve the characterization and get a better sense of what the bioavailability is in order to help us improve the, or at least, let's say, reduce the uncertainty in our risk assessment?
Well, sure. So, the next thing you really need to look at is if there is a method available. And luckily, we've had quite a bit of growth in this area in the last 10 years. So 10 years ago, if you were going to do a bioavailability study for arsenic, you would need to use an animal model. There are a few different animal models available. The juvenile swine is kind of considered the gold standard because their GI tract is very similar to that of a young child. There's also a mouse model, and there are monkey models, but these models are expensive, time-consuming, and of course come with everything that the issues that come with doing animal research. And so it was ideal to be able to develop some benchtop methods. And so luckily we do have a few that are now available. You go to the next slide, please. There we go. So here are a few of the methods that are available for determining arsenic bioavailability in vitro. US EPA has their US EPA method 1340. It was originally developed to evaluate lead in soils, but it's also now available to be used for arsenic. In California, we have our California arsenic bioaccessibility method. And then there's also the unified barge method. There's the IVG method developed at OSU, and then also the physiological based extraction test. So these are all in vitro ways that you can evaluate arsenic in soils. And so luckily for your site, you've got a few different options depending on where you're located. Of course, you want to make sure you talk to the regulatory agency that's involved in your site, so you're using the most appropriate method that will, so that your results will be accepted as you move forward and incorporate them into risk assessment. And then the other big question is, could bioavailability assessment actually affect the remedial decisions? Because if you're going to go in there and collect samples and get a bioavailability value out, but it's not going to really change what it is that you're doing, then it's probably not worth it to spend all of the money, time, and effort. So on this next slide here, we've got a table to help you determine, hopefully this next slide will come up here. Sorry, we're having some technical issues with changing the slides. So this is just a general table to help you get an idea of whether or not it makes sense to do a site-specific evaluation. Because if you say you're going to have a first question, which you've already answered, do you have arsenic above background? And the answer is yes. And then you're going to look at your future land use, whether it's residential, commercial, or recreational. I know you've got a mix of a couple of those. And then look at your concentrations to determine if a bioavailability adjustment is going to make sense. Because if you're looking at a residential development and you've got over 1,000 milligrams per kilogram, even if that came back at 1% available, you're still much higher than our risk-based concentrations. So you're not going to really be able to get away with not cleaning that up, regardless of what your bioavailability comes back as. So these are kind of considerations you need to think about in looking through your site data and seeing if it makes sense to go forward with this, and if it's likely that it's going to change your decision-making process.
That's great. That's actually really helpful. It's good to know that there are methods that we could potentially use in the lab to get a sense or a better sense of the relative bioavailability at the site. Actually, in that last content that you presented, I think is very helpful. It definitely does give us some sense of whether we have some need or whether there's some possibility that this effort, if we were to pursue it, could help us to possibly change or would potentially modify our decision. At least with regards to residential exposure, we have some potential to make a different decision. If you go to the next slide, I think with recreational, that potential actually increases for obvious reasons. There's, to a certain extent, there's a less significant degree of exposure from an ingestion standpoint. So I think based upon these aspects, it does appear that we have some potential to benefit from a reduction of uncertainty standpoint. I guess before we move forward, what might be the next thing we should consider?
Sure. You know, with anything, you definitely need to take the cost into consideration, because none of this work, whether it's collecting the soil samples, creating the data reports, doing the bioavailability analysis, everything, of course, costs money. And so it is important to do a cost-benefit analysis to make sure that actually going through this process is going to result in a net savings of money, or at least it's not going to cost you more than it would have to just go ahead and clean up the site. So with that, we have a question, a poll question. If you could throw that up, please, Nicole. So if you had to guess, how much do you think an in vitro bioavailability study would cost for this site? I'll give everybody a couple of minutes to answer this one. All right, so we've got 71% of you coming in at $20,000, and that's a pretty good guess. So let's go ahead and move on to the next slide and take a look. So this is just a table from the document that talks about some of the approximate costs for different types of analyses that you might do for a bioavailability study. You probably want to look at your soil properties, your mineralogy, and then there's a range, from anywhere from $150 to $1,000 per sample for looking at lead or arsenic. Of course, this is an arsenic site. And then I do want to point out how much more expensive those animal studies were if you had to do an animal study. But luckily for arsenic, we've got a couple of methods with IVIVCs already in place where we have shown that we have an in vitro method that will accurately predict the in vivo. And so if we can go to the next slide here. So what do you think? Do you think the cost is going to make it worth going through and doing this whole process?
Well, I guess based on what we've looked at before, where it appears as though we have a potential to reduce uncertainty here for those two exposure scenarios, and relative to the cost of managing the material, I think, which was relatively high, I do think a cost for a study between, let's say, $10,000 and $20,000 is definitely something that could be beneficial. Actually, if you make a quick click there, Valerie. So we'd actually gone ahead and implemented this. Our approach to implementing this to try to get a sense of how the relative bioavailability might change across the site based upon differences in concentration, was based upon sampling these individual points. And for the sake of this approach, we actually targeted each of the locations that exhibited the highest arsenic concentrations in each of these fields. And then based upon that, it gave us some information, but for the most part, the characterization and the work that we did was on the order of about 10 to 20,000. So I do think it was something that we would take into consideration and move forward with. So I guess we're ready to go, unless there's anything left to consider.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you always want to consider whether or not you're going to have public acceptance of this. You don't want to go through and spend all this money and not be able to explain it to the public in a way that they are accepting and that they understand that you're using scientific information to make a site-specific risk evaluation. You need to look at the regulatory constraints. As I mentioned before, you want to make sure that you check in with the regulatory agency in charge of your site to make sure that you're using a method that they approve of and that they're okay with using. And then, of course, all of your typical logistical and technical constraints that come with any kind of field work. So what do you think, Kevin? Do you think you're going to go ahead and move forward with this?
I do. I think we've worked through each of these elements. It does seem like it makes sense in this case. If you actually make one more click here. So we actually went ahead and, we've taken the samples, as I described before. And what we got out of that is, a relatively tight range of in vitro bioaccessibility percentages that the lab has indicated. An estimate of the average or an upper confidence limit on that mean is about 39%. I don't know if you click it one more time there, Val. So I think we get some sense of that, but I guess just a quick question. So these are the numbers that the lab is providing us. Are these the numbers we should plug into the risk equation, or is there something else that we should be doing with these values before we, we go ahead and modify our risk calculations?
Yeah, that's a really great question, Kevin. So remember, when we're using in vitro data in human health risk assessment, we only can do that if we have a method that has an established IV-IVC or an in vivo in vitro correlation. This particular correlation is for the California Arsenic Bioaccessibility Method, or the CAB method. And what this does is you get that 39% that you got for the IVBA, and you plug it into this equation that's up here at the top, and that will give you what the RBA is that you would use in your risk assessment. I will say, I know for many of these methods, the lab will actually provide you this as well, but you want to make sure that you're really putting that RBA value into your risk equation. I'll show you on the next slide where that goes. So this is where it goes for both your cancer risk and your hazard. I will point out that RBA, 35% is what the RBA is. So you'd be putting 0.35 in this risk assessment. And just to point out that all of our risk calculations do typically consider an RBA, but we consider it 100% unless it's, otherwise determined. And so that's why we just would put in 0.35 for your particular site here in these calculations.
Thank you for that. So we've gone ahead and done that. We've essentially updated our risk calculations to reflect a 35% RBA over the 60% default RBA. And the result of that is pretty helpful. It definitely reduced the footprint of our remediation and what we needed to manage prior to actually going into the redevelopment phase. So if you actually click the next slide. What it did was it essentially reduced the amount of material that needs to be managed down to about 25% of the site, which is still a significant amount, but it's a much smaller area that warrants management than what we had in our original calculations. Thankfully, all that we've done here is essentially reduce the uncertainty in our analysis by taking advantage of a relatively easy, simply implemented approach and relatively low cost refinement. So thanks, Valerie, for helping me navigate through that as part of this engagement. So I think with that, we're going to hand it back to Nicole for to help us sort of navigate through a question and answer break for those interested in asking questions as part of this training.
Great. Yeah, thank you, Valerie and Kevin, for walking us through that case scenario and sticking with us. We are going to pause for some questions. We have had some that our trainers have been answering. So I'll remind you that at the bottom of your screen, you'll see a Q&A pod, and you are welcome to write in any questions that you may have at any time. Jeff, I have one here that I think is best to direct to you. I'm going to read the comment and then let you have a little conversation about it. The comment was, small amounts of soil under your nails, on your hands, especially if you work or play outside, hand-to-mouth behavior, especially in kids, dust in the air, particles you breathe in don't necessarily get into your lungs, but get trapped in your mucous membranes, and you end up swallowing the particles, always for ingestion of soil.
Yeah, thanks, Nicole. I just thought that was an interesting comment that, we all understand the hand-to-mouth behavior, and, it's with adults too, like if you're gardening in contaminated soil and eating or smoking while you're out there, you ingest it. But oftentimes the communities I work with, because I also work for Cooperative Extension, is people wonder about dust. If they're gardening or in other areas where they're inhaling dust. But the lungs are really good at cleaning dust out. So even if you do breathe in contaminated dust, you cough, it comes up as mucus, and then you swallow it. So that's why we end up focusing solely on the ingestion pathway with this process, and can, at least for lead and arsenic, can for all intents and purposes, ignore the inhalation pathway. But that's a great comment. Thanks.
Yeah, and if I could just add to that, I would just say that there are ways that we can look at inhalation and bioavailability of inhalation. Those methods do exist. They're just not the focus of this document. This document is specifically on soil ingestion, but there has been research out there that looks at bioavailability of inhaled particles as well.
Great. I always love when multiple trainers get to comment on a question here. We do have one that just came in that says, do you need to consider the arsenic in the crops grown?
Well, so I'm pausing to figure out how to answer that question best. So arsenic, crops grown in soil with arsenic certainly uptake arsenic. We know that arsenic is present in rice and other crops. However, that is not the focus of this particular ITRC document, which is looking at ingestion, incidental ingestion of soil contaminated with arsenic and looking at bioavailability there. But that is certainly an important consideration if you're growing crops in soil with arsenic, which, as I mentioned before, pretty much all soil does have arsenic in it. That is an important consideration.
Great. Thanks again, Valerie, for jumping in there. All right. Let's do this one, and I am going to tee up Kevin to ask to come off mute for a response. What was the advantage of calculating an RBA based on the average for the whole site rather than the separate parcels? It seems like a few high samples may have increased the site average RBA, but that calculations for individual parcels may have further reduced the HQs for additional areas.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think the way we should be approaching characterizing relative bioavailability of contaminants in soil is similar to how we might characterize sites for other aspects in terms of approaching it from a risk management or risk assessment decision-making purpose. There's going to be variability. And as you could probably see in the basic walkthrough that Valerie and I went through, we sort of cheated a little bit. I made a comment at the beginning of the walkthrough that the soil was homogeneous, essentially consistent across the site. Well, that actually reduces one of the factors that might, be very important. If the soil type is different at different areas of the site, you might end up with different impacts on bioavailability. As Yvette walked through in her slides, there's several factors that can modify or adjust relative bioavailability in a site. So what we've talked about and what we presented in the case study was really a sampling method that you could use to characterize, generally speaking, what the relative bioavailability would be across the site given a certain condition. And when you think about risk assessment and the way we use risk assessment for cleanup decision making, a lot of what we're trying to do is to characterize what's known as reasonable maximum exposure. And so I think in that way, the approach and the mindset you should have is to think about characterizing RBA much like you would be characterizing anything else. So having enough samples to get a sense of what the range is and to think about what conservative estimates of the mean might be, as an element that would be eventually entered into your risk calculations is a kind of a good way to think about that, the problem of refining or reducing uncertainty in that parameter in your calcs.
Yeah, and if I could just add to that, I think it's always a site-specific determination. I have a site that just did the bioavailability analysis for arsenic, and they wanted to do a site-wide average, but there were different parcels associated. So I asked them to look at each parcel individually and then to look at them as a whole to determine, to at least present the data to show me that there was that they were similar enough that they could do a site-wide average, because it's really going to depend on your site, both how your site is laid out and then also future usage.
Great, thanks. We had a question here, and I'm going to tee up Yvette. What solution do you use for in vitro tests to simulate the stomach acid environment?
And that's an interesting question. And of course the answer is it depends. When I was talking about the basics, I talked about in vitro methods and the in vitro to in vivo correlation. So the appropriate method to use depends on the contaminant of interest and also on the regulatory agency that you're working under. So for example, US EPA has EPA method 1340. It is a fairly simple glycine buffered hydrochloric acid solution that is was developed to mimic the conditions of the stomach. And they recommend use, EPA recommends use of that for lead and arsenic to estimate in vitro data, and then using an IV-IVC to calculate an RBA. The state of California has another method that they recommend for using if your site is in their jurisdiction. It's the CAB method, and Valerie can give us some details about that because she was involved in the research to develop that. But it also is a single stage gastric simulating type of solution. Whereas if you're going to be looking at organic chemicals, or maybe even some inorganic chemicals, you need a more complex in vitro solution that includes consideration of what happens in the throughout the gastrointestinal tract. And I'll talk a little bit about that later. So it's not an easy answer, sorry.
No, that's great, I appreciate it. And I think with that question, I'm going to move on and I'm going to set Jeff back up to walk through the next case study between him and Barry.
Thanks, Nicole. So this is our case study on our lead site. I'm trying to see if I can advance. Nope, I'm still locked out. So there we go. Thanks. So this case study is presented as a series of meetings between regulators and consultants. I'll be playing the role of the regulator, and Barry Selko with Jacobs will be the consultant. So when we ask the poll questions, we'd like the audience to act as a team member and then vote on those to give us feedback. So the site we're going to be looking at is a historic lead mining area where urban growth has expanded, and there'll be continued growth in the future, both residential and commercial. Next slide. So here's our lead mining area, and you can click through the next couple. There's some text boxes that pop up. So it's a 3-acre parcel, former lead mining area. The mining ceased back in the 60s, so it's been dormant for several decades, so there's been some revegetation. However, you can see from the aerial photos where the mine tailings were dumped. The tailings are about 1 to 2 feet thick. And the urban growth has kind of moved out into that area in the 80s and will continue to do so. So the specific site we're looking at is a 3-acre parcel with 10 residential properties. Again, developed in the 80s. Oh, let's go back one. With third acres or smaller lots. All of them, or some have play areas and gardens, but each parcel has a distinct front, back, and two side yards. Okay, now ready for the next one. So if you divide it up, and we're going to do our initial sampling for total lead, you can see we've got discrete sampling locations in the gardens and the play areas of the houses that have them. And then we'll have composite sample locations in the four distinct yard areas of each lot. Go to the next one. So the total data set that we'll have to work with is 40 composite yard samples, 10 discrete garden samples, and 5 discrete play area samples. And when we get our data, we're looking at a concentration of lead of 380 to 1300 ppm, milligrams per kilogram, with a mean of 850 ppm and a low standard deviation. So it's clearly enriched all across the entire parcel that we're looking at. The background for this area is calculated to be about 30 milligrams per kilogram. And just a side note, there is a new ITRC guidance document on calculating background values for different studies. The soil type here is a well-graded gravel with fines and thin organic silt at the surface, as one might expect looking at areas where mine tailings were dumped, perhaps with just some natural soil development or a little bit of a topsoil layer being put over the top. So here's our data put back on our table or on our figure. As you can see, the lead concentrations are elevated across the entire parcel. And looking at the total values, using the state screening level of 400 parts per million milligrams per kilogram, all but two of the side yards are going to require remediation. So, I mean, this could be a big job, especially if you're living in the houses while this is happening. The next slide. So I'm now going to have Barry discuss some of the options for on how to handle this site.
Hey, Jeff, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. I'm just seeing if I can control the movement. Okay, so based on the data that we have for our site, we've developed a ballpark cost estimate for excavation and transportation and disposal costs based on the soil volume that we would need to remove since it exceeds the state's default cleanup level. So at this point, we could either excavate all the properties or we could do a site-specific bioavailability study with the hope of reducing the volume of soil that we need to remediate. So we'd like to talk about the viability of doing a bioavailability study for the site. And at this point, we're considering doing a site-specific bioavailability study so that we can develop these site-specific soil cleanup levels that take bioavailability into account. And we're using the decision flowchart from the ITRC bioavailability guidance document to help us think through this and help us figure out if it's worth doing. So this flowchart here shows the things that we're considering, and I'm going to talk through the steps of this flowchart in relation to our site. So according to the flowchart, we need to determine first if there's a bioavailability method that's available for the chemical that's an issue at our site. Well, that chemical is lead. And in 2017, EPA published a guidance on the lab method that we could use for IVBA testing. And so we could use that method. This photo here shows the equipment that's used when performing this EPA lab method. Now, according to this EPA method, we can use an in vitro lead method rather than an animal study, since the validated methods show good in vitro, in vivo correlation on the waste material that's similar to the waste type at our site, which is for mining. And the concentrations in soil at our site are within the range of concentrations that were tested using IVBA according to the EPA method documentation. Well, we looked at the lead concentrations that were detected at our site using the existing data that we have right now. And our concentrations in soil are about 400 to 1,320 parts per million. So based on this figure here from the ITRC guidance document, our site concentrations are within the range of concentrations where bioavailability testing is likely to be helpful. So the next step in the flowchart is determining if the potential benefits of the bioavailability study justify the cost of doing it. So we started looking at the costs to do a bioavailability study. We know that we have to include not just the cost of sample collection and lab analysis, but we also have to include costs associated with other components of a well-documented study, such as preparing a work plan, data validation, evaluating the data, calculating site-specific cleanup levels, and then, of course, coordinating with stakeholders throughout the planning and the reporting phases. So to finish estimating this cost of the bioavailability study that we might be performing, we need to know how many samples we have to collect, since that directly affects the cost of the field work and the data validation and the calculations that we need to do. So how many samples for bioavailability is your agency going to require for our site?
Thanks, Barry. Yeah, so audience members, please go ahead and answer the poll question. The question is, how many samples should be collected for bioavailability testing, not including duplicate samples at this 3-acre site? It's just for the bioavailability testing.
I'm just going to keep the poll open for a minute. We had a delay in getting some responses, so 1 second.
Thanks. All right, so the most popular answer at 57% is 10 incremental samples across the 3 acres. That is historically the most common answer, but in reality, there is no right or wrong answer to this. It's going to depend on the agency that you're working with. As you probably all well know, just it's really important to clarify these details before you go out and do the work, so you don't come back and they tell you to go out and do it again. We can go to the next slide. Next slide, please. There we go. So we will go with 2 composites of 30 increments, and this is based on US EPA guidance for sampling bioaccessibility for lead in soil. And things to note with this is to make sure you get equal representation, volume and depth from all the increments. You can see the schematic there on the right of how you might do your sampling. You're going to collect all your samples in triplicate. Yeah, so you've got 2 composites done in triplicate, each made up of 30 increments or subsamples. And there is an ITRC incremental sampling methodology guidance that you can use, and we recommend that you review that and go through that first before you head out to do your work. All right, we can do the next slide. So because the soil type here is homogeneous, being it's all mine tailings, and it's a single source of lead, meaning it's all, yeah, again, all coming out of the mining. There's no smelting being done nearby. The decision unit could be the entire property area, the whole 3 parcels. But we had agreed on 2 samples. So it's going to be 2 decision units with a similar concentration range. So here you can see our diagram where we collected our 2 samples. And recall, also, they're done in triplicate within each decision unit. Go to the next slide. Another thing, the important thing to realize with bioavailability sampling is that you do your soil sieving somewhat differently. Standard soil studies sieve to 2 millimeters. That's considered the size fraction that's what's considered soil. But bioavailability studies, you need to sieve samples to 150 microns. This is the size that sticks to hands and gets ingested most readily. Next slide. So just to recap, so without conducting a bioavailability study, we'd be looking at excavating the entire site, all 3 acres, 1 to 2 feet of depth, and that would cost over $700,000. So after the bioavailability study, potentially, you could see a relative bioavailability of 20 to 30%, which is not uncommon in mining sites. Based on that, you'd say your excavation volume actually goes to zero. And what it would cost you would be the cost of this study, which would be about $30,000. Also to realize that this remedy will still be protective of human health without having to disrupt this neighborhood. Next slide. And there's some further considerations to take into account, as is always the case. One is public acceptance. The residents, especially now after all the news about lead in drinking water are going to be very sensitive to this. They've been hearing 400 ppm probably as the cleanup target. So when we go and talk to them, we need to be able to explain very clearly why we aren't going to use that 400 part per million cleanup standard and why that's okay. So probably be very helpful to prepare fact sheets and presentations with an overview of bioavailability concepts and the study details. Make sure it's understandable to the general public, and that's generally considered at the 8th grade level of education. So can't get too technical or jargony in it, or people won't be able to follow you. There might be other regulatory constraints. Perhaps a health agency that you work with is not on board with this. Hopefully they will. There also might be technical constraints. So if you have co-located contaminants, so like if you're in a historic apple orchard where they use lead arsenate pesticides, you'll have to look at both. Both contaminants. We can go to the next slide. So we decided that the consultant would move forward with the bioavailability study. It's going to use method 1340, dividing the site into 2 decision units, an incremental sample in triplicate from each decision unit, and then calculate the site-specific soil cleanup levels using these results. We can go to the next slide. And so now the work is done. And we're ready to discuss results before a final report is written. Barry, could you tell us what you found?
Sure. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Okay, good. I can move the slides too. Okay, so thanks for having time to meet back with us today. We got the bioavailability data back from the lab, and we'll be talking about the results that we found from that. So first of all, the lab reported our results in terms of IVBA. So we had to do a few calculations to put those lab results into a form that we could use in the lead models so that we could calculate the site-specific cleanup levels. Now, first, we had to calculate the relative oral bioavailability. And the documentation for that EPA method 1340 provides an equation for calculating the RBA from the IVBA results. And so that's the equation that we used. And as you know, we have triplicate incremental sample results for each decision unit. And the lab provided the IVBA, and we calculated the RBA for each sample using that equation in the lab method. And that equation uses values, not percentages, to calculate the relative oral bioavailability. And the results range from 0.14 to 0.17. So when we express it as a percentage, the RBA ranges from 14% to 17%. So we saw close agreement between the triplicate results and between the two decision units. And the residential lead model, the IUBK model, it uses this absolute bioavailability term rather than the RBA. So we had to calculate that too, so that we had the appropriate value to use in the IUBK model. Now, since EPA estimates that the ABA of lead from the diet is about 50% in children, we calculated that ABA, the absolute bioavailability for each sample, using 50% of the RBA. So our ABA results range from 7 to 8.5% for the incremental samples. So again, we have close agreement in the ABA for all the samples. So since we saw close agreement between the six ABA results, and because the lead model uses the arithmetic mean lead concentration as the input parameter, we could either, you know, use the average of the six measured values, which is 15% relative oral bioavailability, or we could use the higher 95% UCL on the mean between the two triplicate samples, or we could use the maximum RBA for the six samples. So what is going to be acceptable to the agency?
That's a good question. I'd like the audience members to weigh in on that.
Great, the poll is up. We're just waiting for a few more responses here.
Great, thanks, Nicole. So yeah, it looks like most people at 66% went with the higher 95% of the UCL on the mean of the two triplicate samples, and that's acceptable here. Again, okay. There's no right or wrong answer. Just make sure to work it out with your regulatory agency beforehand.
Okay, well, we thought that might be a case. So that's the value that we're presenting in our draft calculations today to represent both decision units in the lead model. So lead exposures are assessed with pharmacokinetic models, and the IUBK model for lead in children is used for residential exposures, and the adult lead methodology is used for non-residential exposures. Now, both of these models have a default relative oral bioavailability of 60% from soil and dust already incorporated into them. So we replaced that default RBA with the site-specific RBA. And section 9 of that ITRC bioavailability guidance document shows the detailed steps on how to incorporate site-specific RBA into the lead model. So we followed that detailed guidance in the ITRC document. Now, to calculate the site-specific soil cleanup level, we need to know the target blood lead level to use for the models. In 2017, EPA published a document indicating that adverse health effects could occur below a blood lead level of 10 micrograms per deciliter, but they didn't recommend a specific target blood lead level to use. So for these draft cleanup level calculations that I'm presenting here today, we used a target blood lead level of 5 micrograms per deciliter. Now, we ran the IUBK model with the site-specific RBA data and a target blood lead level of 5 micrograms per deciliter, and we calculated a site-specific residential cleanup level of 580 parts per million. So you can see that the site-specific bioavailability study resulted in the site-specific cleanup level that's higher than the default state cleanup level of 400 ppm that we had been using based on that default RBA of 60%. And we all have to remember that this site-specific cleanup level still remains protective of children. It's a site-specific value. So if the area remains residential, some of the areas will need to be remediated, but it's a smaller area than the original area that we had thought based on that default RBA of 60%. Now, since this area is also being considered for future commercial land use, we also ran the non-residential lead model, that adult lead methodology, with the site-specific RBA and the target blood lead level of 5 micrograms per deciliter. And that gave us a site-specific commercial cleanup level of 3,800 parts per million. So this site-specific cleanup level is higher, of course, than the default state cleanup level based on the default RBA of 60%, but it still remains protective of these commercial receptors if that's the way that this land goes. So based on the site-specific commercial soil cleanup level, no lead concentrations at the site exceed the cleanup level, so no remediation would be needed. But we do recognize that certain institutional controls would be needed to prevent specific types of commercial land use, such as a daycare facility, because we wouldn't want that if we have a 3,800 ppm there in soil.
Thanks, Barry. This is really good information and will provide us with a lot of good options as we think about this case. Just to recap, what we found is that the site-specific bioavailability study reduces the uncertainty in the site risk and risk-based cleanup. It reduces the disruption of the residents. They don't have to have all of their yards excavated to 2 feet. It reduces remediation-related risks. Again, if you got a lot of kids around, truck traffic can be a hazard. And it also reduces the remedial action costs potentially by a lot. It also gives us additional site-specific data to supplement our initial nature and extent sampling. It's decisions protective of human health. Again, that has to be paramount, and you have to make sure that the community understands that. It also gives us the ability to achieve the same target risk level, gives us flexibility and remedial options. But again, as mentioned, stakeholder outreach is going to be really important. So in this case, it looks like it would be a good method to use as we're looking to remediate the site to protect human health. Now I'm going to turn it back over to Yvette to talk about PAHs.
Thanks, Jeff, and thanks to both of you for that great case study. That was useful to go through. Let's see if I'm able to, okay. So as promised, we're going to talk a little bit about organic chemicals in soil and what's known about the relative bioavailability from soil of those. So, PAHs, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, are one of the organic chemicals that have been studied in soil more than others. So that's going to be the focus of the presentation today. So what are PAHs? It is a class of chemicals. It is not a single element like lead and arsenic. There are over 10,000 individual chemicals that are considered to be polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, 7 of which are currently considered carcinogenic by EPA. They are quite different than the metals and metalloids. Sorry for you purists out there. The metal and metalloid we have been talking about so far. Because they are lipophilic. They are generally known to have low water solubility, and most of them have low vapor pressure. So they remain in the environment for quite some time, which makes them of interest. Next slide. So there are many sources of PAHs to soil. Some of them are natural. So basically, when you have incomplete combustion of organic material, you generate PAHs. So forest fires, grass fires, volcanic eruptions, oil seeps are all natural sources of PAHs to the environment. But there are also quite a number of industrial sources, which are listed here, and non-industrial sources, such as landfills and fire training and auto emissions. So as you might imagine, with all of these sources, there are quite a few contaminated sites. And so PAHs there's a lot of interest in remediation strategies, how to clean them up, and consequently, whether there are bioavailability considerations. Next slide. So PAHs are among the most common chemicals of concern at contaminated sites. And unlike lead and arsenic, where we were talking about before, where there is a default assumption of 60% RBA, from soil. For PAHs, the current default assumption is that 100% RBA, which, as we've talked about, means that the absorption of PAHs from soil are equivalent to the absorption of PAHs from PAH spiked food. Next slide. So with all these sources, there's considerable interest in incorporating bioavailability estimates for PAHs into human health risk assessments. I was looking at these slides earlier, and I guess we have been doing this training for a little while because this slide is somewhat out of date. But the statement in the bullet is still true, which over 60 studies have been performed to date, including in vivo and in vitro. And I can say it's an area of active research, so that number is increasing. Some of these studies have supported site-specific RBA adjustments for use in risk assessment, but there hasn't been a comprehensive set of studies like there has been for lead and arsenic that support some defaults or support an IV-IVC. But what this research is doing is helping to elucidate the factors that are controlling how PAHs bind to soil and what kind of binding might be affecting the bioavailability. But currently there's still no consensus on in vitro methods or even animal methods that should be used. Next slide. So, the methods for estimating bioavailability for organics in soil have lagged behind metals and metalloids such as lead and arsenic, partly because the assessment is really complex. PAHs are a chemical mixture. The analytical costs are much higher. You know, with lead and arsenic, you know, you can go get a lead analysis of your soil for under $100. You can get an estimate of IVBA for under $1,000. For PAHs in soil, I think the analytical costs for just characterizing concentrations in soil are over $1,000. And that doesn't include any of the IVBA or RBA study. It's also more complicated because of metabolism. So I am always embarrassed to admit that the first time I was asked to design a study for an organic chemical to look at bioavailability, I basically took an old lead study. I took out the word lead, put in the word PAH, and thought I was done, which was just appallingly naive. I've learned a lot in the meantime. So one of the big challenges is that with lead and arsenic, you dose lead and arsenic, and then you find a measurement endpoint for lead and arsenic. With PAHs, you can dose your PAH, but it gets metabolized. It gets metabolized in the liver. It gets metabolized in your target tissues. There is microbial metabolism inside the gut. And it doesn't only get metabolized to one thing. They get metabolized to multiple metabolites. And so, you know, you dose PAHs, but you do not necessarily want to use assessing PAHs as your measurement endpoint. One of the strategies to get around that is to say, well, I'm not going to look at what gets absorbed into the animal. I'm going to only look at what stays on the soil and remains in the gut. So, and then I can assess what the bioavailability is by subtraction. You know, what didn't come out in the poop must have gotten absorbed into the body. Well, that conceptually sounds like a great idea, but it turns out that PAHs go through this cycle of what's called enterohepatic recirculation. It sounds like really fancy, but basically what it means is that PAHs get absorbed from the gut, go through the gastrointestinal wall, and then go to the liver, where they are then excreted back into the gastrointestinal tract. And so there's this cycling and recirculation. And so you can't just do a simple mathematical calculation of, or arithmetic calculation of what's in the gut means it wasn't absorbed. The in vitro methods are also more complicated. So as we talked about before, for lead and arsenic, generally what has been identified is that there are, you know, it's the acid conditions and other factors in the gas in the stomach that result in the leaching of the lead and arsenic from the soil. Whereas for PAHs, it may get the soil may break down in the gas in the stomach, but the absorption largely occurs in the intestinal environment. And so any kind of in vitro method needs to incorporate both a gastric and intestinal component. And then you have to do the analytical, which is expensive. All right, next slide. So given all of this and all of these problems, what did we do in the ITRC document? We provided, you know, we kind of put on our regulator's hat or a, you know, what do you do if somebody comes to you and says, oh, I've done a study of bioavailability of PAHs at a site. As a regulator or as a scientist, how do you evaluate that study? So in the BCS document, we talk about what is the appropriate soil particle size that should be evaluated? When you evaluate these studies, is there a relevant comparison group? Like, are they doing that right? Have they established linearity of pharmacokinetics? So earlier we were talking about lead, early swine tests with lead, and that you could see a clear dose response curve, and that relationship was linear as the dose went up. The response went up. Is that true in the dose range that they study in the study you're considering or you're evaluating? Did they do a repeated dose or a single dose? Either could be done correctly, but it can be a little bit tricky because organic chemicals often induce the enzymes that metabolize them. So in a repeated dosing, you may be affecting your perceived absorption because of the induction of the enzymes that are metabolizing your contaminant. Does the study measure parent compound? Does it measure metabolites? Does it measure both? And does it explain why it's doing that and that how it is being done is an appropriate measurement endpoint? And then, of course, classic study design issues such as, are there an adequate number of subjects given the variability? Do they look at relevant concentrations in doses or a number of different doses? This is definitely an issue in the PAH literature. What people have found, they can report really useful information about the relative bioavailability of PAHs, but the doses that they give and the concentrations in soil that they have to administer are so high, it isn't really relevant to real world situations. Is there an ability to demonstrate a full range of RBA? Are there soil factors that affect bioavailability over a broad range? Are they reporting an average value across individuals, or are they looking at the variability across individuals, which might be important? And then do they do a mass balance? When they feed these chemicals, do they know where it's going? Okay, next slide. The other thing that the BCS document discusses is, what do we know about PAHs specifically? So what do we know about sources, toxicity? What are the factors that we have learned from the existing literature that are influencing the RBA from soil? What is known or what has been done in terms of in vitro studies and in vivo method development? The document provides a summary of research conducted to date. It also discusses some considerations for dermal absorption, because PAHs are also absorbed through the skin, and that can also affect your risk assessment. So it's an important thing to be considered. And we provide a case study. Next slide. Oop, go back one slide. So what we know. So over 60 studies have been done. Conclusive IVIVCs have not emerged from them, but what do they tell us? If you take the literature in total, what it tells us is that the sources of PAH to the soil dominate how the PAHs then behave in the soil, and how they are partitioning from the source to the soil and back and forth. And that is what affects the bioavailability. So the source of the contaminant is really important. Some sources have been shown to pretty consistently have higher relative bioavailability and others significantly lower. For example, soot, skeet, PAHs were used in the making of skeet historically, and pitch, all appear to have lower relative bioavailability. The PAHs are really tied up in that source material. Conversely, if you have a PAH source from fuel or napples, those appear to have very high bioavailability. The research has indicated that compared to lead and arsenic, the soil characteristics appear to be less important controlling RBA. Peat and clay content isn't as important, but something like charcoal being included in the soil or a high black carbon content in the soil does reduce the bioavailability. And that might be really important as a potential remediation strategy. So the PAH is partitioned from the soil into the charcoal and then gets tied up and remains inaccessible or not bioavailable. The research to date also indicates that dermal exposure pathway is important to be considered in the risk assessment. And there's more work to be done, and there is more being done. As I've said, PAHs have been site-specific studies that supported RBA adjustments and risk assessment. The final slide for this section just captures what I just was walking through, the concept. This is a reprint image from an article published in 2015. And it's really just trying to explain that if you have some sources of PAHs, they may be tied up in these very slowly desorbing PAHs. So those are the red dots. So it's in the soot and it just does not come out. But conversely, you might have some PAHs in peat in soil or the natural organic matter. And it looks like those leach out relatively faster. Pitch might have some of the quickly desorbing materials attached on the outside, but the bulk of it might be tied up inside the pitch and not desorb. And similarly with char, it seems to really hold on the PAHs, as opposed to something like fuel oil, where it might be trapped within the mineral phases of the soil, but the PAHs in that oil are actually quite bioavailable. Next slide. All right. With that, I'm going to hand it back over to Valerie to talk about moving forward and, you know, how to take action on this at a contaminated site, and to address, we'll then address some more questions and answers.
Thank you so much, Yvette, for and everybody, for all that we've learned today. It has been a lot. So I just want to tell you how to get moving forward. So our document is online. This is the web address. And when you go to it, this is what you'll see. This is the front page. If you go there, you can see over on the left-hand side, we have a panel that shows our different sections. And you can go through and see that we have an introduction that goes through the definitions and theory. Regulatory background talks about the existing guidance and the state acceptance that was current as of 2018 when we finished this. The technical background, so both the soil science and mineralogy that goes into having an impact on bioavailability. The decision process, that tree that we showed you in both case studies, and also the cost-benefit analysis. We have methodology sections about the in vivo studies, in vitro studies, and how important that in vivo, in vitro correlations are, and how you can determine if one is appropriate. And then we have our chemical specific chapters. We have one, just as we followed with our case studies, we have one on lead, arsenic, and on PAHs. And we have a section on risk assessment, how to incorporate those RBA values into your risk assessment, and stakeholder perspectives, where we can look at how you can work on engagement and outreach and communication with the public, and those are going to be impacted by these decision-making processes. And finally, we have a section with some case studies. This is just showing you the top of the table, where you can actually pick what contaminant you're interested in, what type of soil was there, the source type, and then the state. And we've got a bunch of case studies that you can click through and determine if one of those might help guide you on your own site. This is one of the figures from our document. And one of the things that this is showing you is just a way that you can use our document to help you determine what volume of soil you are going to need to remediate and how RBA can have an impact on that. So for this one, we have two different sites here, site A and site B, both of which have a maximum concentration of 1,000 milligrams per kilogram. Let's just assume this is lead. And then we have one that has site A has a log normal distribution, whereas site B has a linear distribution. And you can see that if there's a 20% RBA value, then that changes the cleanup value to 500. And this is just showing you that on site A, you know, the amount of soil you're gonna have to remove that is above that cleanup value is pretty limited, versus in site B, it would be a much larger amount of soil you'd have to remove. And these are just, this is provided here to give you an idea of planning your process as you move forward and what RBA, how RBA might impact the amount of remediation that's needed for a particular site. This is another way to show it. I really like this kind of simplified version. So let's take a look at our typical site. This is showing you have a hotspot of 100 milligrams per kilogram, then an area with about 30, and then an area of 15, and then you've got your clean soil, say below background if we're talking about arsenic. And so with a relative bioavailability of 100% and a cleanup goal of 1 × 10⁻⁶, so that's a risk of 1 in 1,000,000, which is our point of departure for US EPA. In terms of risk decision processes. So there we would have a cleanup goal of 10 milligrams per kilogram. And so in this scenario, we're going to have to be cleaning up all of these areas of soil. And that's a whole lot of truckloads of dirt that are gonna have to be removed and trucked through a neighborhood and hauled off to an appropriate facility for disposal. Now, let's say We use that US EPA default of 60% bioavailability. In this scenario, again, using a 1 × 10⁻⁶ cleanup goal risk, so a 1 in 1 million target risk. Now, because we've made some site-specific modifications to our risk assessment, the cleanup goal, that risk-based cleanup goal, is 17 milligrams per kilogram. And so now, while you still need to remove these inner areas, this area that has 15 milligrams per kilogram is allowed to be staying in place. And that reduces the amount of trucks of soil that are going to need to be dug up, hauled out, and go through your neighborhood and disposed of. And so let's say we did a site-specific evaluation, and we determine that our relative bioavailability is 25%. Using that RBA to adjust our risk assessment, we now have a cleanup goal of 40 milligrams per kilogram. Again, still based off of that 1 in 1 million risk. So we're not compromising risk here. We're just using site-specific information to adjust our risk assessment. Now we're only going to have to clean up this center area where we've got that highest concentration of contaminant in place. And that greatly reduces the number of trucks that are going to have to be hauled through your neighborhood in terms of disposal of those soils. So I just really like putting it in that perspective. I think it gives us a nice view as to how using site-specific evaluations can really impact not just your cleanup, but also the surrounding community in terms of how we remove things. I wanted to go back. There we go, sorry. Within the document, we do have this review checklist available to you. So I recommend if you're going to consider doing a bioavailability study, a site-specific study, that you go ahead and you print out this checklist and you just work your way through it. And it'll help you determine all of the things that you need to consider while you are evaluating your site. And then finally, we have some specific take-home messages for you all to consider. Again, the purpose of coming up with a site-specific RBA is to decrease the uncertainty in the risk assessment. We're using actual data to know that we know that many of these, like we know that lead and arsenic are not 100% bioavailable in soils. And so we're decreasing the uncertainty by determining RBA and adjusting our risk assessment. We can still maintain our same target risk level. This isn't at the expense of risk. This is just using scientific data to adjust that risk. So this can improve remedial decision-making, and that often does lead to a significant savings of the resources available for remediation. This is a multidisciplinary process. You should involve your whole team early. So what does that mean? From a regulatory standpoint, I work for California for the DTSC, and we want to make sure that our project managers, our geologists, and our risk assessors and toxicologists are all on board, because we all have important things to add to this decision in terms of what the best soils are to collect, what concentrations you want to target, the distribution, whether or not you're going to use a 95 UCL or you want to do ISM, all of that. Consultants, of course, they're the ones who are going to go out there and do the work. So everybody needs to make sure that we're planning the sampling in an appropriate way. And then, of course, the stakeholders, because you really want to make sure that the public is going to have some buy-off in what you're doing, and that the responsible parties are as well, and that they believe in the process of site-specific bioavailability and the data that it provides us. And that's it. And now I'll hand it back over to Nicole for our follow-up final.
Great. Thank you so much. So I have just dropped into the chat the link to the feedback form, since the slide links are not active here in the Zoom webinar. I want to first thank all the trainers. I noticed on the slides that this document was produced in November of 2017, and they have been training since that date. So lots of great information and lots of people trained. So thank you very much for your dedication to the training course and to ITRC. We are going to pause here for one final Q&A. We will end at the top of the hour as a just to close this out. So if anybody has any final questions, I encourage you to use the Q&A pod. We did have some promotions for some of our other ITRC events or guidance documents that I will just note for you guys. So the Soil Background and Risk Assessment team, did finalize their document in December of 2022. They will be having a webinar. It is not open for registration yet, but it will be on June 23rd. It will be an expert panel, and they will be showcasing their brand new videos highlighting the guidance document information. We also just completed our incremental sampling methodology first expert panel. It was all Q&A, great information shared. That was hosted on April 19th, and that archive will be available soon. If you missed the class, I encourage you to go back and listen to the 1 hour archive of the Q&A format from our experts.
Nicole, there was one question in here that I thought was more of a comment, but I thought was interesting, and it's different than any that we've had in the past.
Great.
Can I jump in with that? So the comment was, leaving soil in place may result in less impact to the community due to less dust from excavation for remediation, fewer emissions from haul trucks and excavating equipment, less noise and traffic related to remediation. All of these benefits may counter the extra cost of doing a bioavailability study. I thought that was an interesting comment, and I'll say I have some thoughts, and then I'd be curious if some of the others do. I am on board with this comment, except for the very last statement. So to me, using a bioavailability study, especially if you can do in vitro bioaccessibility testing that is quick and easy and cheap, it's the perfect complement to this kind of discussion of a holistic solution to remediating the site. So, you know, we don't want to have the disruption. We don't want to take down our trees. We don't want to have all of our sod removed. We don't want to suffer the slings and arrows of remediation. But look, we have done a bioavailability study that indicates we don't need to clean it up. And we still have, you know, we can still meet our target risk goals that the regulators are likely going to need to have to sign off on a decision like that. So I would say I agree, and you should do the bioavailability study as part of that stakeholder involvement that Valerie was just talking about, and the involvement of everybody who needs to be who's affected by this. Sorry.
No, I appreciate that. Great comment to bring it to attention. Any others here while we pause for a moment? Okay, well, as I see people starting to log off early, I am going to go ahead and close the webinar and stop the recording. With a big thank you to everybody for attending. We do look at your feedback, so please take a moment to complete the feedback form that is in the chat box. And we look forward to seeing you on future ITRC webinars.